Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
What's the difference between crafty campaigning and negative campaigning?
The objective of any negative tactic is to damage your opponent, but what a consultant or a candidate would try to do is damage your opponent without any backlash.
Nevada and South Carolina are voting this weekend. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Bill Radke. Also this hour, Kara Oler thought she knew what she was looking for.
We said we were interviewing refugees, and she said, well, you should interview me and my family. I'm a refugee. I'm from Afghanistan.
We continue our series about the one thing people bring with them when they come to America. And where does a world-class architect find his ideas?
You test different paths, and that some of these paths lead you to nowhere, but others suddenly open up into frontiers that you had no idea were accessible.
We're listening in to the music people use to propel their lives on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. And from partner station KUOW in Seattle, I'm John Moe in for Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. We continue our Listening In series this hour. Architect Daniel Libeskind designed the World Trade Center tribute and the Jewish Museum, but he doesn't do it alone. We'll listen in to the music Libeskind uses to launch his day. So what about you? What song motivates you to get to work?
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Oh, just about any song, as long as it's outlaw country.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun.
A song that gets me motivated to do work is Listen to the Music by the Doobie Brothers.
Some Neil Diamond songs, actually. Cracklin' Rosie, get on board.
Mm-hmm, Hayward son, there'll be peace when you are done.
The song that motivates me daily is Bob Marley. I just like to hear his voice. Put a little reggae in my soul. Everything's beautiful. Everyone's beautiful.
Bill, that's just like where we work, where everyone's beautiful.
That's right. I think he's had three little birds on his doorstep.
I think he did, yeah.
Those voices came to us from Chicago, Minneapolis, and Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, presidential candidates and their staffs have been hard at work for a while now, especially in South Carolina, which holds its Republican primary today. There is a lot at stake for the GOP contenders. Mike Huckabee could be in trouble if he loses, or he could be the front runner if he wins. John McCain is trying to show his New Hampshire victory was no fluke. But candidates have one other thing to worry about in South Carolina: dirty tricks. The state is infamous for anonymous mailers, fake polling calls, all manner of hardball negative campaigning. The gloves come off and the sucker punches fly. Rod Sheely knows this very well indeed. He's a career political advisor in South Carolina, and though he isn't working for any candidate this time around, he's been known to get his own hands dirty from time to time. Welcome, Rod.
Appreciate it.
The perception of South Carolina politics is that there is just a lot of mud being thrown around. Why does there seem to be so much mud in South Carolina politics?
Well, actually, you know, we here in South Carolina are very civil, very friendly. I don't think it speaks to our state as much as it speaks to the importance of this particular primary in the sequence. You know, they've turned the corner from Iowa to New Hampshire. It's now time to get serious. This becomes a do-or-die state. You either win or go home in many instances. Candidates and the national campaigns are essentially willing to do whatever it takes, and they've got to do whatever it takes, which means no holds barred, go for it. Now, I will say that we here in South Carolina, the political community, those my fellow consultants and I, they all know how to play the game of negative politics. We all studied or worked with Lee Atwater.
Fill us in on who Lee Atwater was.
During the 70s and 80s, Lee Atwater was a young South Carolinian who rose to the pinnacle of political power. He managed the first George Bush's campaign for president and then became chairman of the RNC, was stricken with a brain tumor, and we lost him in the early 90s. But he proved himself to be a cut above virtually any other political person. He was a master strategist and certainly understood how to run a negative campaign. He is credited during the 88 Bush campaign with the Willie Horton ad, which is considered one of the masterstrokes of negative political campaigns.
Now, a big part of South Carolina, shall we say, dirty politics, kind of the really negative stuff that has been going on through the years, seems to be anonymity, anonymous mailings, anonymous push polling. Why is that? What's the deal with anonymity in this context?
Well, the objective of any negative tactic is to damage your opponent. But what a consultant or a candidate would try to do is damage your opponent without any backlash. Certainly the voters will tell you they do not like negative politics, and they do not like negative politics. It works. They respond to it, but in general they don't like it. However, they usually don't recognize it as negative politics, and so the candidates tend to get away with it, largely because the attacks tend to be anonymous or in some cases third person.
You've been in this game for a long time, Rod. What are some of the all-time greatest negative political maneuvers in South Carolina that you've seen?
You know, I think the 2000 campaign against McCain was probably one of the best examples, and it's certainly best known. And it was not a specific tactic. There was just an unrelenting assault against McCain on all fronts, coming from supporters of Bush. And certainly a campaign generally has to take responsibility for their entire campaign, which is the collective group of everyone who supports and is working for that similar cause. In 2000, during the lead-up to the South Carolina primary, McCain had just about had enough, and the McCain campaign launched their own attack ad against Bush. However, McCain made a decision after one day to pull that ad and stop it. But the damage had been done. He actually pulled the ad and issued sort of an apology and said he had let an attack ad air, but he regretted it. Well, that's all the Bush campaign needed to go on the attack against McCain for running a negative campaign. On Election Day in 2000, most South Carolina voters had in their mind that McCain had run a negative campaign against Bush. History certainly has recorded otherwise.
What motivates you in your work? What drives you?
Less and less am I motivated by any specific political philosophy. Frankly, this system, I believe, was set up to be balanced. I appreciate the balance, and somehow the system all works itself out. Am I totally happy with the system? No, I'm not. But frankly, if I simply play the small part of helping good people get elected, regardless of which side of the fence they're on, I think I've accomplished something.
Rod Sheely, thank you so much for being with us.
We appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
You can find out more about some of the past political antics of Rod Sheely at our website. There is too much to go into here, but he's done some doozies. There's his sister's campaign and $500 and a KFC. Just read about it at our website at weekinamerica.org.
Today's other vote happens in Nevada, where both Republicans and Democrats are caucusing. This is the first time Nevada's had a major role in the election. The state's parties moved up their caucuses to win more attention to the issues that affect that chunk of the country between Iowa and California. So as the candidates get ready to move onward out of Nevada, we wondered, has the Interior West gotten the attention it was looking for? Larry Swanson studies the region as director of the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West at the University of Montana in Missoula. He says the candidates came west, but really only scratched the surface.
When you look at this region, it's a region that there's a much richer sort of political texture to it than what you can get in most of these sort of fast and sort of wholesale-based political campaigns among these presidential candidates.
So you haven't noticed the campaign conversation being much different?
Not enough. I mean, not in the way I've seen it covered.
Well, let's talk about the texture of the Interior West. What makes it a unique region in 2008 that
merits special attention from presidential candidates?
Well, it's one of the fastest growing regions in relative population growth. There's kind of been a big migration shift over the course of the last 15 years, and more people are actually moving into the interior West from surrounding states and areas. So the interior West has become fast growing. It has a fast growing economy. As a matter of fact, the income base of the interior West is the fastest growing among all regions of the United States over this 15-year period. And it's also a place that's sort of quickly urbanizing. While from a distance, people might think of this as kind of a rural place and a non-metro with a few big cities, some of the fastest growth is in small cities and urban places, and that's starting to get reflected in kind of the changing politics of the region.
How does all this growth and mixing and urbanization affect what voters of the interior West want to hear from presidential candidates?
When you travel around, the sort of the single biggest umbrella issue area, you know, in communities and areas are things related to growth and change. I mean, people come to this region a lot of times mainly because they're attracted to the, you know, high quality environments, the big wide open spaces. So, you know, if you would walk into almost any community in the region where this growth is occurring, they're spending an inordinate amount of time thinking about where this growth is going to go in the future, how to better manage it, what kind of place are we becoming as this change occurs. We're into this big dialogue, and sometimes when you overlay this with these presidential campaigns, there's such a huge disconnect.
Okay, so let's say the West was more like Iowa in the campaign. Okay, candidates have been crawling all over the place for months, pandering to your concerns. What would candidates be talking about?
Well, when you come to this part of the world, whatever party you may be, put on a bolo tie and a pair of cowboy boots, and it's going to sell no matter where you are. But be prepared to talk substance. You sort of tick off the areas. I think the West is changing with regard to how it views education and the funding of education because the economy is moving away from very narrow dependence on natural resources and more into a much more human resource-based economy. The attitude toward the environment and the protection of the environment is steadily changing in the West because so much of our growth is amenity-driven. So that's changing the sort of stereotypic idea that the West is sort of automatically against measures to protect the environment. You'll find from state-to-state increased interest in this region for also doing things about global warming. And I think that needs to be part of the discussion. Also, we've got this extremely tight workforce that's developed here, although we're going into a nationwide recession. And one of the things on the front burner of everybody's thinking is how to invest in workforce development and those kind of things. And I think each region of the country has a different way of talking about these things that's important to filter into these presidential discussions.
Larry, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Larry Swanson is the director of the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West at the University of Montana in Missoula.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
If you're going to ask a refugee what connects her to her homeland, be prepared for a story you'll never forget. That's next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, you're listening to Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. Over the past year, we've been bringing you stories of refugees who have come to the United States, and we've talked to them about the one thing that they've brought with them to remind them of home. The series called One Thing. Producers Ann Happerman and Kara Oler found so many compelling stories that they couldn't fit them all into the series, like this song. Ann and Kara, welcome to Week in America.
Thanks, Bill. Hi.
Thanks. Hi.
What are we listening to?
We're listening to Ro Tlong Ne. He's a refugee in Indianapolis, Indiana, and he and his family are Burmese Chin. And he's singing a song he wrote about a girl. It's a love song, but it's in his native Chin language.
Actually, we interviewed his father, and we wanted to include Ro just because he came about, I think it was 6 or 7 years after his father. And he had some stories just about what it was like to really adjust as a high school teenager.
He said that between passing periods when he was first going to school, he didn't understand what anyone was saying, and he would go in the passing periods and cry between classes. And I think, you know, a lot of the high school students we talked to had the same kind of experience.
What's a story of how some of these refugees are dealing with the big differences between where they've come from and where they are now?
Well, the Burundians are a real new population that are being resettled here in the United States. And one of the cities that they're going to is in Phoenix. And we talked with a group of men who were very newly arrived refugees who'd been there, some even just a couple of weeks, some there just a few months. And so for them, it was a really recent experience of, you know, just this transition from Africa. And one of the guys had this pretty hilarious story about, you know, what people told him Phoenix was going to be like.
One of the staff told him that Phoenix is even hotter than Africa, and that the sun is very, warm. And then that's how I really found it to be the reality. There are also other people who live in Phoenix. I'm not the first one. And luckily they have technology that can convert that heat into cold.
Technology that converts heat into cold, meaning air conditioners.
Exactly.
Yes. We were meeting all sorts of people in the Burundian community and talking to them about, like, their first impressions. I mean, especially in Phoenix, you know, cars, like, all over the place, how they were just still kind of taken aback as to how many cars there were.
How did you find these stories, anyway?
We worked through social service agencies. We worked through Lutheran Family Services and Church World Service.
And Catholic Charities. A lot of the organizations that directly deal with and resettle the refugees.
But then there was one situation where we had worked through a social service agency in Amarillo, Texas, and we had 5 interviews set up over the course of 3 days. We were checking into our hotel, and we both started talking to the front desk clerk, and she asked, you know, what we were doing. And we said we were interviewing refugees. And she said, well, you should interview me and my family. I'm a refugee. I'm from Afghanistan. And so we ended up canceling all of our interviews and just spending the whole weekend with her family.
You know, Lena was such a, and her family were so wonderful and open. And, you know, they had never met us.
2 weeks after when I came from Afghanistan, my mom took us shopping, which is Walmart. And my little sister, she asked me I can take her to the bathroom. And I couldn't read English, which is where the bathroom is. Finally, I see a door, and I open that door, and the whole Walmart would start beeping, like the emergency alarm come on, and all the people with the blue vests was around me. And I was really scared, really, really scared. And I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know how to tell them that I'm just looking for the bathroom. So that was the most embarrassing part of coming to America.
You mentioned that Lena was very open with you. Were there stories you heard that you were reluctant to share with us on the radio?
Both Karen and I were extremely moved by how willing people were to share with us some really horrendous things that happened to them.
I just hope if anything comes out of this series, it's that people can have some kind of personal connection to, you know, on the news every day you see pictures of war and conflict, and I think it's hard to have a personal connection to that.
One of the great themes running through the series was music. So many people shared their songs, their music with you.
On our first trip to Portland, we actually had a group of Somali Bantus who gathered together in their apartment and sang and danced for us for about 2 or 3 hours.
It was amazing.
Yeah, it was instruments that they had made.
And instruments that they had made out of a bedpost and motorcycle brake wires. It was amazing. The same thing happened in Phoenix. We walked into a room and we asked, you know, we'd love for you to share some stories with us about your culture, about your journey here. And so they said, well, what we'd really like to do is sing you some songs.
Now, they're going to explain a song. This song is a song about God.
Mire, mire, chale, madze, ndaruha, yesu arande mesha. Madze, ndaruha, yesu arande mesha.
As it was translated for us, what they're singing is that they have climbed these high hills. They have come so far, and they're thankful to God that they've been able to finally make it to where they are.
One thing that every single person said to us was that, you know, they still have people back in other countries. And everyone that we interviewed was hoping that somehow from this interview that people would realize that their family members were in other countries and that they could be brought here.
Yeah, I think that they just want people to know that they're here, and maybe we should all be listening to their stories.
One Thing series producers Anne Hepperman and Kara Oler there. They're still in contact with the refugees they interviewed for the series, and they hope to keep working with them, keep telling their unfolding stories. You can listen to all the One Thing stories at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
It's just a simple bit of rope tied into a loop. But as symbols go, the noose is powerful. A history of lynchings and the significance of the noose in a Louisiana town just ahead. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Along with Bill Radke, I'm John Moe, and it's time for your letters. 2 weeks ago, we brought you a story about a man who gave up his cell phone. Well, that must have struck a nerve because we received many responses, including this one from Barbara Metz, who listens on KUOW in Seattle.
I only have a cell phone, and guess what? Sometimes I turn it off, leave it at home, and even, if you can imagine such a thing, sometimes I don't answer it, even though I hear it ringing. This guy's problem is not about having or not having a cell phone. It's about needing to have a story that he thinks makes him unique.
2 weeks ago, in our Good News, Bad News, No News segment, our panelists made light of research into a drug to block the effects of cocaine in your brain. Cynthia listens to us on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. She asked that we not use her last name.
I bet none of your panel have been touched by addiction. They are talking about it way too lightly. As one whose family and community have not only been touched, but even crushed by addiction, it was painful to hear addiction issues made so light of. It is a scourge. How I wish there were a vaccine, because it seems that young people still think that they are invincible.
And finally, every week we send out an email newsletter about what's coming up on this weekend show. You can sign up for that at weekendamerica.org.
And last week we mentioned an event about human-animal communication. Susan Mullen from Seattle wrote in, "People seem to like to make fun of this, but I can tell you that it's real. It can be very helpful to animals and to people." Well, Penelope Smith is an animal communication specialist and the author of the book Animal Talk. It's about animal telepathy.
Telepathy is sort of like extended senses. Tele means distance and pathy means feeling, and that means communicating at a distance. So if I'm communicating with a dog and I ask them, "What was your day like?" I am able to get what the dog senses. So I could get what the dog smelled that day, what they saw, what they heard, what went on with them. It's sort of like a direct connection with them without words.
Do animals have that level of complexity to them? I've always understood that they lack the ability to reason. They lick you because there's salt on your body. Are you anthropomorphizing them into people a little bit?
Where did you get that from? You're getting that from ideas about them rather than getting to know them.
I could take them out for dinner, but it would be a very awkward evening.
When you start to really understand, the animals shift in their behavior and they cooperate more, and you have a better relationship. So I'm all for that.
Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
My body is my closest animal friend. It is an animal. It's a human animal, and it needs whatever it needs. Sometimes it requires some fish.
Have you ever, and I'm just trying to find a non-callous way of phrasing this, have you ever eaten anybody that you knew?
Well, we don't kill our own animals, you know, in this society. We don't kill our own
food. Well, we don't eat our pets, sure.
So,
But do you have a connection with any of these? Like, do you feel anything from these animals that you're eating?
When I ingest a fish, I always thank them.
Do you ever get sick of, you know, skeptical jerks kind of saying, "Oh, you're a pet psychic"?
You know, there'll be people that are skeptical. I welcome skepticism. You should be skeptical of something you don't know anything about until you find out about it yourself and experience it. But I teach people how to experience it. I teach people how to get past their human-acquired socialization and start to open up to the universal language, which is the language of feeling.
Penelope Smith is an animal communication specialist in Prescott, Arizona. Penelope Smith, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Well, we don't know what you're thinking unless you tell us. We don't have that power. So go to our website, will you?
Again, that's weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, this is the radio show about the American weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles with John Moe in Seattle. This Martin Luther King Day weekend, the election is bringing up issues of immigration and race. And another word is still explosive, as we found out last week when an anchor on TV's Golf Channel was suspended after suggesting that one way for young players to deal with the challenge of Tiger Woods would be to, quote, lynch him in a back alley. Now, when you hear the word lynching, you probably think of white-on-black violence in the Reconstruction South. But California photographer Ken Gonzalez Day has come face-to-face with the history of lynching in the American West. He's written a book about it. Ken, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
We all know about so-called frontier justice in the Old West, but how are you defining lynching?
I used the Tuskegee Institute definition, which it is sort of a guiding post to how we think about an execution that is illegal. So, for example, it says there have to be three or more people. There must be a presumption of guilt. And I also extended that by adding that there also had to be a rope involved.
Victims of these Western lynchings were primarily Latinos?
The largest single group, yes, is Latinos, and the largest section of that is what we would think of as Mexican or Mexican-American today. After that, Native Americans, Chinese, and Anglos of various different nations, including one Swiss.
You have photographed some of the trees that still exist today. You call them hang trees. You've brought some of your photos of these hang trees with you. And I'm looking at this one, which is a California oak, and it's next to some modern building.
It's some sort of business complex that hadn't yet been occupied at that point.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this.
Lynch mobs in California preferred the California native oak over all other trees, partially because they're native, so they were here, partially because they grow very, very slowly and have very twisting branches that are very low, so it's very easy to throw a rope over. Part of my thinking was that these were the last witnesses. If it wasn't the exact tree, the mob walked underneath it on their way to the next tree. And my thought being that the tree has been there, in some cases they could be up to, they say, perhaps 400 years old. And capturing these last sort of witnesses was part of the interest for me because they may one day all be gone. As you can see from the one that's been built around, the odds of that tree surviving are pretty slim because you can see in the photograph as well, there's this lovely landscaping with little flowers and sprinklers. If you water that tree every day, it's going to be dead within probably 5 years.
How does this historical project, for you, relate to the America of today?
On one level, we can see it in the immigration debates that are going on all over the place. On another level, we can see it in debates around racial identity that are coming up in the elections, that are coming up in the way that we think about who we are and who we are as a nation, not just as individuals. So I don't worry that lynching is going to come back per se, though we have seen all the nooses and all kinds of other manifestations of that coming back. But the ability to heal as a society has not yet happened. People get very sensitive. People get very insecure around these issues. And we just need to bring it out and talk about it.
You've related these lynchings to today's immigration debate, which is a little touchy. What connections do you make there?
Well, yeah, I mean, without being too provocative, I mean, obviously, we don't want to use the term lynching too loosely, but lynching as a practice was only one aspect of the way that Latinos were disenfranchised in the 19th century. They had restricted citizenship on a number of levels, and that could range from the business world to the economic world to the political world. So when we talk about lynching, it is the most spectacular one. It's the one that we are drawn to as a people, but it's only one aspect of many aspects. The legacy of lynching is a very powerful one, and it can be a very frightening one, an intimidating one for all kinds of communities. And so we need to come to a broader view of our understanding of race relations in the U.S.
How do you feel differently, knowing what you know now?
I think it helped me process a lot of different experiences that I had never really thought about. You know, I guess I'll never look at trees quite the same way again. But when you think about the landscape in California, you probably think of a very pastoral, beautiful image. And it's probably taken by a number of, you know, Weston or Adams or a number of photographers that are well-known in their fields. And they construct this idea of a landscape that is sort of race-neutral in which there are no people, there are no races, there is no conflict. And part of my photographic journey has been to go back and look for these sites. There's still beautiful photographs, there's still beautiful trees, but I hope that the viewer will rethink their assumptions about how they look at photographs of landscapes.
Ken, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
This weekend, photographer and writer Ken Gonzalez Day is putting up photographs from his Hang Tree series at the Austrian Cultural Forum in New York City. You can see his work and watch Ken explain some of his photographic techniques when you go to weekendamerica.org.
The era of lynching may have passed, but the image of the noose can still be incendiary, as residents of Gina, Louisiana learned last year. You may recall the story. At an assembly, a black high school student asks if he can sit under a tree where white students usually sit. The next day, three nooses are found on the tree. In apparent retaliation, a group of black teenagers beat up a white teenager. The district attorney tries the group as adults, charging attempted murder. 20,000 protesters pour into the town of 3,000 residents. It's a powerful story, but do facts back it up? Amy Waldman writes for The Atlantic Monthly and visited Louisiana for a story in this month's issue. Amy, is Gina racially divided?
There is a racial divide in Gina, and I would say most of all it takes a geographic form in that the actual town of Gina has never incorporated most of the black areas around it. So even the Gina Six technically don't even live in Gina. They live right outside of it, and that means that those living outside the town lines, they can't vote for mayor, they can't vote for police chief, they don't have their garbage collected, things like that. That said, relations are largely cordial. At the high school, I think in general, the different races get along. That's one place where I think you actually see greater integration than maybe other places.
There emerged two characters in your story and really in the reporting of the story. There was Michael Bell, the black student who participated in the fight, and there was the white prosecutor. Who were they in your understanding of these people, and how cut and dried were their roles in these incidents?
Reed Walters grew up in a town near Gina, went to law school elsewhere in Louisiana, and then came back and settled in Gina and has never left. And he said at one point to me, you know, I feel as a prosecutor I'm representing the values of my community. And I think he felt like he was doing the right thing, was quite certain and insistent he was doing the right thing, and yet wore blinders to how narrowly the nature of his community was defined. On Michael Bell's side, Michael Bell, the Gina Six, almost became this icon or group of icons for people to rally around.
So when you compare this to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, is it that we lack the right symbols, the right characters, the right kind of stark imagery to affect social change, positive social change, or are the issues so murky that we really can't have that simplicity this time around?
I think to an extent it's almost a misreading of the 60s, though, because then individuals were used in service of the larger issue. I mean, someone like Rosa Parks, you know, the real issue was where could you sit on the bus? It wasn't Rosa Parks herself. And I think she was aware of that. And I think everybody at the time, you know, it wasn't about characters or symbols. It was about laws and enforcement of those laws. And I think now, you know, when we try to make it about symbols and characters, we're sort of missing the point. Michael Bell is a 16-year-old kid who punched another kid and, because of the way he was charged, became a hero for it. I don't know if that's the civil rights movement that we want to build today. You know, Rosa Parks, when she acted, she wasn't just acting for herself. She was acting for all blacks at that time who couldn't sit where they wanted to sit and couldn't vote and so on. The Gina Six, to me, I guess that's what I didn't see. I didn't see where was it about more than the Gina Six. In Gina, I felt like there were specific issues that do need to be addressed when it comes to race. You know, the quality of indigent defense, which affects blacks and whites, but I would argue disproportionately affects blacks. The fact that there are still some schools that, in fact, have never actually desegregated. And so you have parents in Gina who are sending their children outside of the town to public all-white schools so they can avoid integration. The town lines drawn so that the black areas are mostly excluded from the town. These are difficult issues that take time to resolve, that will take sort of tenacious, dogged, not very exciting work, often kind of bureaucratic work. And I think it's easier to just go for the character-driven story rather than taking on these kind of drier issues.
Amy Waldman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Amy Waldman's story, The Truth About Gina, appears in this month's issue of the Atlantic Monthly.
This weekend's NFL playoff games are perhaps best watched at home by the fireplace with a steaming hot mug of beer. We are in the deep freeze. Here's John Moe's look at weekend weather.
The Wisconsin Dells, unsurprisingly located in Wisconsin, offers all sorts of options at this weekend's Flake Out Festival. Mitten football, snowman making, frozen turkey bowling, snow slide. The one thing they don't offer, degrees, high of zero. Visitors are permitted to bring their own degrees, but make sure you pack them in an insulated cooler. Showers and 46 degrees outside in Long Beach, Washington, with a nice stiff wind. Good weather for kite flying, a fact totally ignored at the Windless Kite Festival, held indoors. I think it's held at the same time as the Long Beach Running Around Really Fast in a Gymnasium and Getting All Out of Breath Festival. I wonder if those two events are related. Austin, Texas has a reputation for being a little weird, and that weirdness is a point of civic pride. At the Keepin' Austin Weird Chase, teams traverse the city on a scavenger hunt with treasure maps, encountering odd guides who can help or, weirdly, not help at all. Weather? Cloudy and 55. That seems dull. How about 700 degrees and flying hippos? For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Start your day by furnishing your mind. We're listening in to the music that drives architect Danielle Liebeskind on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by LendingTree, helping customers find the fixed-rate loan that's right for them. You can choose from up to four offers today, 1-800-555-TREE or at LendingTree.com. When banks compete, you win.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with John Moe. In our Listening In series, we've been exploring the many ways people use music in their day-to-day lives. Today, we're listening in with world-renowned architect Danielle Liebeskind to the music he uses to start his day. Liebeskind is well known for his designs at the Jewish Museum in Berlin and the Freedom Tower at Ground Zero. He listens to a solid block of uninterrupted music every morning before heading to his studio. Series producer Gideon D'Arcangelo listened in with Liebskind to the music that helps him seize the day.
I don't think I would have a good day if I wasn't able to start by listening to music.
In his studio, perched high atop the skyscrapers of downtown Manhattan, Danielle Liebskind and I listened to the music of his morning ritual.
So it's not something of a luxury. It's almost a necessity. And it's not a background. I don't do it as, you know, hustle and bustle of domestic life. And in the background, there's music. I sit down when I have the time. And mostly I do have time early in the morning just to listen to a piece of music.
On his morning playlist this week is Fugue No. 22 from The Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach, played by the incomparable Glenn Gould.
There's a lot of tension in this piece because it's almost like a slow-motion machine of some sort. You can hear the gathering sort of thunder behind the very, very deliberate notes. And they do gather, but without the kind of fury of an effect. Somehow, to me, it's like an unfolding of reality. And it's particularly incredible in the morning when it's early. And it's almost like a figure of, you know, emblem of the how the world opens up.
Listening to
We're listening to Messiaen, Oliver Messiaen, and it's an amazing set of CDs.
Liebskind's bright blue eyes shine through his blue-rimmed rectangular glasses with special intensity when he's listening to music. Liebskind was a talented musician himself before becoming one of the world's busiest architects. In addition to the many buildings his studio is currently working on, a grand piano he recently designed will come off the production line later this year.
The idea to listen to music is not to be distracted by anything else. It's to kind of go into it and not to think and not to be thinking about what you're doing or anything intellectual at all. It's an emotion.
Next up is Cab Calloway's take on the classic St. Louis Blues.
To me, this is almost like a compression of, you know, Walt Disney, Marx Brothers, the vitality of sort of America in some indescribable way, which is in this music. So I kind of love it for that reason. It's particularly beautiful when I listen to it and I see the skyscrapers of New York out of my window. And I think of, you know, this was the 1920s, and it's still, New York's got that vibrancy. Oh, I love this piece here, right now. This fantastic invention of language. I mean, look at the inventiveness. I mean, talking about out of the box. These musicians were out of the box way before architects discovered that they can, you know, introduce a new thing into their works.
Liebskind cues up an obscure free jazz improvisation by pianist Keith Tippett, recorded in Berlin in 1989. One of his longtime favorites for the morning, because, he says, it mirrors the beginning of the day.
It kind of starts with some choppy sort of inventions that don't seem to go anywhere, and then suddenly breaks into sort of an amazing crescendo of total fantasy. It shows that you test different paths, and that some of these paths lead you to nowhere, but others suddenly open up into frontiers that you had no idea were accessible.
I ask him if he sees any common thread running through this eclectic mix of music.
I suddenly realized that all of them were individual. There's Glenn Gould playing by himself. There is Keith Tippett playing by himself. There's the great organist. And there's the Cab Calloway. So they are individuals.
It seems that, for Liebskind at least, listening to personal music made by individuals really works at that intimate time of morning when one is trying to organize oneself to face the day.
I would never listen to a Beethoven symphony in the morning or a choral work by Monteverdi. Intuitively, I would think it's the wrong time of day, maybe in the afternoon or towards the evening. So maybe there's something, because it's an individual facing reality, whether it's, you know, jazz, whether it's improvisation, whether it's an organist playing, it's someone. And you can identify somehow with that act of individuality, which to me is the most precious thing.
Leaning over, chin in hands, with his elbows on the massive table in his conference room, Liebskind gets fully immersed in the music. I wonder if one of the reasons for having a morning music ritual is the kind of all-absorbing focus one can get when listening to music.
It's the equivalent for the soul, what, you know, running and jogging would be for the body. It's not for the body, it's for the soul. But the soul also needs to be fed, otherwise it's empty. And that music, when you fill your mind with it, your mind isn't empty during the day. You know, it's furnished.
In New York, I'm Gideon D'Arcangelo for Weekend America.
Last weekend, we asked you what music gets you going in the morning, and this weekend, we have your answers at our website. Go and make yourself a motivational mixtape. Go to weekendamerica.org. Well, we hope we have furnished your mind this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm John Moe at partner station KUOW in Seattle. You can download a free enhanced podcast of this entire program at weekendamerica.org. Now get out there and enjoy your weekend.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
It's the weekend, time to do all the things you can't during the week. Eat brunch, sleep in.
Typically, I roll over in the morning and I open my eyes and there's people already waiting for me. And they say, good morning, Jody. Like, morning, morning.
Life casting means recording the events of your life and streaming them over the internet. Sharing your weekend with 3,700 friends. Join us for the next Weekend America.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.